Okay, can we start unleashing? We've got a hard close at 6:30, when three of us have to disappear. So if we could try and make sure we get whatever papers we want completed by then, David and Danielle. Okay.
I'll just give a very brief update on things. We've got two sessions lined up this week on leases. Focus today is going to be on lessor accounting. Agenda paper 2A for the ISB and FASB memo 180. The extent we have time today, we'll probably move into sublease accounting afterwards, which is the next paper in sequence, 2B or paper 182 for the FASB. But as I say, our focus is really today going to be on lessor accounting. So with that, I'll probably just hand over directly to Katrina.
Okay. Thank you. It's agenda papers 2A, and there are also some appendices to paper 2A that I'm going to talk to now on lessor accounting. Before I actually get into the paper, I just want to mention Michael Gonzalez, whose name clearly appears at the top of this paper, but isn't, unfortunately, with us today. And Michael, surprisingly and frankly, without any consideration for his team colleagues, decided that getting married today was more important than being here to discuss lessor accounting. I told him to keep his mobile open for calls at any point. Anyway, only to say Michael has clearly contributed significantly to a lot of the thinking behind this paper. And by the way, in the appendices, he once again demonstrated why he is the king of numbers in Excel. and unfortunately, I think Michael won't be with us as a team for that much longer, and that's unfortunate for us, and also, of course, unfortunate for you today, because I'm afraid you're going to have to put up with me rather than Michael. So with that, maybe I'll get into the paper. What we want to do with this paper today is take a bit of a stepped approach to walking through the paper and basically what a single lessor accounting model would look like if the boards decide to go for such an approach. So I'm going to just briefly explain how we think that model fits into kind of the overall leases model we're developing. And then, as I say, go kind of step through how that model would actually get applied, first of all, to some different lessors and then on to some different types of underlying assets. The reason for the kind of stepped approach is basically to try and pinpoint where the pressure points are, where there are particular concerns in applying such a model, across the sort of leases industry. And then the plan is that at the end, we'll then sort of circle back and come back and ask for voting around, the overall model, whether it makes sense to go for that model in the context of, all leases, possibly during the discussion, whether there are some tweaks or changes that need to be made to the model that's in the paper, in order to get the boards there, or otherwise if we decide to stick with sort of the status quo on lessor accounting. So first of all, I obviously have already, and I will continue to refer to a sort of single lessor model. And I know that some maybe in looking at the paper might question, is this really a single model or not? And I suppose that in our eyes, it is the single model. Why do we say that? And I suppose with the exception of investment property at fair value, which we take out of the picture, the reason we think it is a single model is that the lessor is always recognising a receivable and a residual. The only difference in the approach might be that it could lead to a different profit and loss recognition profile in the case that there is some uncertainty around profit. So I suppose in our eyes, we don't see that as being any different to some other pieces of GAAP or some other projects. For example, the revenue project where you would say, I won't allow, I'll say that a lessor would have to defer profit in the case where there is any uncertainty surrounding that profit. So how does the approach sort of fit in with the overall leases model? Well, we've defined a lease such that a lessee actually controls the use of the underlying asset during the lease term. meaning that while that asset's leased, the lessor does not control the use of that asset. So the lessor can really only get access to that asset in terms of using it at the end of the lease term. So therefore, that's why we think that actually recognising a receivable and a residual often is a better way to reflect the position that the lessor is in, having entered into a lease contract. The lessor no longer has the underlying asset available for its use. What it has is clearly a receivable from the lessee, and it also has a right to get the underlying asset again at the end of the lease term. So maybe with that, if we first of all discuss and think about how the model gets applied to a bank lessor, and again, I'll sort of discuss in the context of a bank lessor of a whole underlying asset, so let's take a piece of equipment. In the case of a bank lessor, a bank usually is financing the purchase of the equipment. So it buys in the equipment, but almost immediately that equipment is leased out to the lessee. So obviously because of the timing of purchase and leasing, usually the cost of the equipment is exactly the same as its fair value. So when we talk about a bank lessor, there usually isn't any day one profit issue that exists. And it's Appendix A1 to the paper that sort of looks at this example. And in Appendix A1, the cost and fair value of the asset there is $10,000. So those people who sort of support the kind of application of the single lessor model to a bank lessor situation thinks that it is sort of more appropriate, better reflects, what's going on in that transaction, I suppose, for two reasons. The first is that the bank has really priced that contract to receive a constant rate of return. So again, in the example in A1, the contract's been priced to get a 10% rate of return. So the sort of single lessor model, what we're calling the receivable and residual approach, and Appendix A1 shows that the way income ends up being recognised there means that the bank would be showing a return on its assets, of sort of constant 10% return on its assets. Compared to obviously if current operating lease accounting was applied, where straight line income recognition would mean an increasing rate of return on the leased asset. And I think the second piece is obviously in the case of a bank, the bank typically, when it's a lessor, never actually receives physical possession of the underlying asset. So again, in our equipment example, the equipment's often delivered directly from the manufacturer through to the lessee. So the only connection the bank might have with that equipment is on paper. It's the legal owner, but otherwise it never receives, as I say, physical possession or ever uses it at all. So again, for that reason, we think that showing a receivable and a residual in that case is a better reflection of what's actually happening. So maybe to start off, what I'd like to do is ask the boards whether, in the context of thinking just about a bank lessor when it's a whole underlying asset, whether you are comfortable or if you have any particular concerns about applying the sort of receivable and residual approach in that situation. And obviously, before you speak, please don't feel weary and think I'm leading you down a path you possibly cannot return from. Because, of course, whilst I'd like to do that, rest assured, as I said, what we're trying to do is step through it, work out where the tension points and concerns are, and clearly at the end we're coming back and looking at the overall picture. So anyway, Phil, you can make your comments and you can get out of it again at some point later in the process when we talk about portions or real estate, etc.
Petrina, the one you described is very much like a finance lease. As you said, it gives of the asset to the individual company, so there would be actually no change either in this model or the existing model.
I think that
it might have a tiny residual.
I think it's often the case that bank lessors, what they enter into are finance leases from their perspective, and maybe don't want to take on, exposures to the residual. I think that is the case, so there still are some bank lessors that do enter into what would currently be considered operating leases.
Tom?
I don't know if I want to confine myself completely to the bank lessor setting, but I think you're asking the question, generally, could I support a model that would remove the underlying asset and recognize a receivable and a residual, not necessarily just limited to the bank lessor setting. I think that's one key decision that takes the two approaches in contrast to. I think I could be comfortable with that. The only area where I get concerned with is when I start thinking about portions. And so that's not going to be the bank lessor setting, but if you're asking me whether I take the underlying off the books and then recognize a receivable and a residual, the portions is the issue for me. So let's say you're not in investment properties, and maybe that's not going to be the prevalent circumstance, but you're not in investment properties and you're doing lessor accounting, and you're renting one floor out of 40 and you're keeping 39. I have a little bit more pause to then break up that underlying asset into three parts. The 39-40ths that are the original asset that would be at amortized cost, okay, depreciated cost, I assume, and then the one story that gets broken into a receivable and a residual. That, I think, is an open question that we have to decide when we decide whether we have one model or not. And so I think if you look at paragraph 9 versus 10, there's a stark contrast between those as to about derecognition of the underlying and breaking it apart. And portions is an area that I think is very important that we have to resolve. Absent another decision I hope you're going to get to is how do you do revenue recognition if you accept that base model? And I'm not so sure that we have to necessarily do revenue recognition based on measurability. It could be on transfer of risk and rewards also.
But just to clarify, we will definitely get to talk about portions specifically and also definitely get to talk about the revenue profile as we step through this.
I want to challenge you, Tom, about portions. Should I ask now or later?
I would prefer that we talk. Portions is absolutely in here, and we want to talk about it, but I'd rather talk about it later.
Could you just hold it? Thank you.
Comments on the general?
I have a question.
Trina, about a bank lessor. Is it all banking lessor activities, or is it only those where it has been leased for a significant period of time?
No, it would be in the context of all.
All?
Yes.
Sorry, I missed that.
It would be in the context of all leasing activity. So whilst a lot of that was finance lease, it also could include operating lease.
Yeah, my view, I don't feel comfortable in all cases having the bank, or any lessor for that matter, put the entire receivable and the entire residual asset on its books when they plan to generate sufficient value from that residual asset. I think leasing activity is different if you're leasing it for substantial all of its economic useful life versus, say, some short period of time.
And what's your main concern, Russ?
I believe that it should be depicted as equipment. I think the economics of leasing equipment for its entire life is different than leasing it for a shorter period of time, because the lessor will have the residual risk, and they should call it. I think calling it equipment is useful.
Larry?
The residual is going to be on the books. So you could just say, you know, residual value of equipment under a lease or something like that. I mean, I thought Petrina teed this up by saying this would be applicable to situations where the lessee controls that asset. So the lessor effectively, you know, for the period of time that it's under lease, can't use that asset.
But that's another way of looking at portions, right?
No, this is not a portion.
Well, a 10-year life asset, you're only leasing 5 years. I think Russ is saying in that circumstance, he'd like to see the whole investment property on the lessor's books, not the 5 years worth that you're keeping and the 5 year that you're not broken into two parts.
I totally understand what Russ is saying. I just disagree.
Larry just disagreed. Fine.
Okay.
It seems
We have to discuss this issue.
For me, no problem at all. We should understand that you know, accounting is only a monetary number. And nowadays, just a digital record. And you not agree to derecognize, you know, part of the value of digital record. You know, if you look at the think about the issues, you will say, I would think the building is still your buildings. You know, you can keep all the digital records, say that this is my building, I hold the titles, I hold the ownership certificate. No difference at all. The only difference is we derecognize. You know, some of us and one Chinese friend say that maybe we should change the term, you know. Derecognition give people wrong image. I kick out my old buildings and bring another buildings. No change at all. You know, the only difference is you derecognize or you move out part of the value which you already, you know, we already decide. The other side control, and you not control. So I have no problem at all, you know, to move part of the value from your side. And you can still, in your mind, say it in the computer, this building is my buildings. And the whole values in my buildings, no problem at all.
Okay, other points? Steve?
I agree with Wegro that perhaps derecognition is the wrong word, because it's not as though we're removing an asset from the balance sheet. We are recharacterizing it as to what it now is. And it's no longer a piece of plant and machinery that we're using in our business to generate profit. If we lease an asset for 50% of its useful life to somebody else, what we now really have is a receivable with all the characteristics of a receivable, with credit risk and the like, and interest rate risk, and we have a residual asset, which we will get back at the end, which we will do whatever we want to do with. So we're just recharacterizing the plant and machinery into what we really have, which is a receivable and a residual asset. That's the way I see it.
I mean, I find that line of thinking attractive, but we did not embrace that line of thinking for financial instruments. So if I simply monetize part of a loan that's carried at cost through a set of contracts, et cetera, we have much higher hurdles to recharacterize things on the balance sheet and take a gain. And it's I'm struggling with why, upon entering into a lease, we think we should realize any built-up appreciation on the underlying asset.
I think the gain is a different issue, and we'll come to that, because I agree in many circumstances you shouldn't recognize a gain, and there should be a high hurdle for recognizing a gain. But I don't see any hurdle at all to characterizing instead of plant as receivable and residual.
As long as both of those things are accounted for consistently going forward, I agree with you.
Yeah. Larry?
And that is my major concern, is there seems to be a disconnect where, you know, I'll speak personally, I seem willing to recharacterize this, and I think it's a better characterization of what the lessor is entitled to, much better than saying they have this whole asset, which they don't. But it bothers me that we've set the hurdles very differently than we have financial instruments. And I don't know if it's the idea that the lessor has lost control of the underlying asset, whereas in a financial instrument, frequently the holder of that financial instrument hasn't lost control over it, but yet will take the cash, repackage it, and send it out. And maybe that's a fundamental difference that's worthy of different accounting. I haven't thought it through entirely.
Is it the fact that we do recognize there is a receivable? That's quite clear. We've recognized that in finance leasing for some time. We have quite clearly economically the residue of the asset sitting there. Is one of the concerns, Larry, when you talk about high hurdles, the fact that there may be a gain sitting in there that can pop out?
Yeah, that's
so if we took care of the gain, would that make you happier? You've got to see how it's done, of course. Yeah, you know.
Yes.
We'd like you to be happy.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
David. It's so nice to be with you.
That's primarily where I'm at, too.
Yeah.
I was troubled by thinking about a finance lease in if we're retaining existing accounting. No, if we continue with the vote we had last week, where our last month or whatever, where our board would have basically said no receivable on a finance lease for a bank. That's problematic for me. I'm much more able to wrap my arms around receivable residual, and I might probably get there on portions too, but I think we just have to make sure it makes sense. The big problem I have is with revenue recognition or gain or loss recognition, and I don't like the idea of waiting based on measurement. If you say you can measure something to get a gain, everyone will be able to measure it. I could get to the staff's recommendation in paragraph 9, except that I would draw the cutoff not on measurability on revenue recognition, but on significant risk and rewards. If significant risk and rewards are transferred, I get the gain up front to the portion that I've transferred, and if not, I recognize revenue over time.
So if it was a manufacturer lessor and he leases for the entire life of the asset, you're quite happy he gets the gain. If he leases for a couple of years, you get a bit shaky about it, and you'd rather he just took the rental income and whatever else and
recognize revenue over time. Yes.
Right. Okay. I'm the same. To be fine.
It's revenue recognition consistent with paragraph 10, but using that revenue recognition cutoff in 10 and accounting for it as in 9. So in 9, the accounting would say, derecognize the asset, recognize the receivable and the residual, but then decide how you're going to account for the revenue over time. And 9B, the 9 second part says, no revenue up front, basically.
If it makes sense, because we've already started to get into the profit picks, does it make sense that we go on and talk about manufacturer lessors?
Well, it might do, because that's where the key point is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, unless
it's
anybody else
generation
wants
of profit
to
when there's not enough there.
I think we have to talk about portions. Now, I understand what you said. I don't think you're really comfortable with portions.
I said I might get there with portions.
But Petrina's teeing up a single lessor model. That means if you agree that you should have a receivable and residual for equipment, we're going to get walked down a path that says she does the same thing for portions.
She said she wouldn't do that.
I know. But we're going to get walked down a path.
Russ, you have a greater concern about this than I do. But I have a concern. I'd like to have us walk down the path on portions to see if it makes sense.
And if it makes you feel comfortable, you're right that I am walking you down a path. And that path is talking about whether and when you feel comfortable, either with, you know, receivable and residual on the balance sheet and when you feel comfortable. And absolutely, it's right. The last piece in this, by the way, the next piece is manufacturer lessor, the next piece is whole investment property, and the very important last piece is portions. And as I say, what we're trying to do is not to say, look, if you sign up to the first piece, that means you've automatically signed up to the last and you're stuck, is that we want to go down it and work out, as I say, where are the tensions, where are the concerns, how far down the model can we go, in a sense, before people start to get really uncomfortable and say, well, look, no, receivable and residual doesn't make any sense in that context. That's where I think, you know, current operating lease account or whatever is better. So it's trying to work out how far possibly we can go with a single approach, and it might end up coming back and saying then, well, you know, we
Russ,
keep...
If you had a different objective, you could do the reverse order and you might get a different response.
I think Russ wants to walk down a portion of the path.
Mark, are you trying to come in?
I want to walk down this path.
Oh, you want to walk down
as we walk down this yellow brick road, I guess I was just, I put my light on when Leslie was raising the concern about components approach kind of and how it relates to financial instruments. And I just wanted to raise that if we go down this road and we try to figure out where the consistency is, because in financial instruments we did set it differently. On the lessee side, we set it differently too. I don't disagree with the idea of recognizing and measuring the assets that you have, et cetera. But on the lessee side, remember, we decided not to do that. We could have done the fair value of the right to use asset. We could have measured the option to renew, measure the option on contingent rents, and we decided that's too hard, we're not going to do that. So now we're inconsistent on the lessor side with the lessee, and we're inconsistent with where we were on financial instruments. So we just have to understand where all those inconsistencies are and be able to explain it.
Okay. If it makes sense, I'll move on to manufacturer lessor. I'll try to build in why we think this model is consistent with lessee, so I'll see if I can convince you of that. So manufacturer lessor, which we've already got into, so assume we're talking about the same piece of equipment, it's still equipment. It's just a manufacturer lessor in this case. And obviously when it is a manufacturer lessor, there can be a difference between the manufacturing cost and the fair value of the asset. And obviously anywhere that there is a difference between carrying amount and fair value, there could be day one gain to be recognised by that manufacturer lessor. Now, I think as we've already discussed, what we don't necessarily want to go into is I think if the lease conversations that we've had says, I think we all feel reasonably comfortable with the manufacturer recognising profit in that case, you know, at lease commencement, because in fact, that's what happens today under finance lease accounting, and in that case, the residual asset will be pretty small. Yeah. So I think everybody's reasonably comfortable with the manufacturer recognising profit when substantially all the risk and rewards transferred. It's obviously when we fall below that, so what are current operating leases, then we start to feel a bit more uncomfortable.
Can we just check, everyone quite happy with that at the moment? Okay, another few steps down the road, off you go.
Yeah. Down the yellow brick road, as you say. So then obviously we should talk about what potentially does the manufacturer, you know, what is the profit that might get recognised? And the amount of profit that may get recognised obviously depends on how the residual asset is measured. In the paper, and it's in paragraph 20 of the paper, we set out two ways that you could measure the residual assets. Approach one, is an allocated cost basis. It's similar to what was in the ED under the derecognition model. And as I say, effectively the residual asset in that case gets measured. It's an allocation of the previous cost amount. Whereas approach two would measure the residual asset sort of closer to fair value on a present value of the estimated future value at the end of the lease term. Approach two would kind of more closely reflect how a lot of lessors price contracts, but it would mean full manufacturing profit being recognised at lease commencement. So, for instance, if you look at the table that's just after paragraph 23, the approach to would mean, you know, recognition of full manufacturing profit of 1250 in this example, whereas approach one, and if you, again, you see in that table, approach one would mean the recognition of profit of 1,017, because what approach one effectively does is mean that the manufacturer would just be recognising profit on the right of use asset that has been transferred to the lessee. There would be no recognition of profit on the residual asset that it retains. Any profit on the residual it would only recognise at the end of the lease term. I think on balance, as the paper said, we as staff, if we could answer, we support the approach one, so it's the allocated cost basis. I mean, first of all, I think because we think it better reflects the fact that the lessor has transferred control of the right of use asset to the lessee. And maybe to your point, Mark, that's how and why we see this model fitting in with lessee, is we see the lessee's recognising the right of use asset that it now controls. And this approach would say the lessor is able to recognise profit on that right of use asset that has been transferred, assuming that profit is reliably measurable. The other reason why we go for approach one is we think it does address some of the concerns about recognition of day one profit. Paragraph 33 in the paper tries to talk about, you know, obviously the concerns that are around day one profit and how or why we think approach one addresses some of it. I'll just mention a couple of those. One is that obviously under approach one, the residual asset has been measured on an allocated cost basis. So naturally, because of that, there is a buffer built into that measurement. So effectively, you know, day one profit would only possibly be overstated if the future estimate of the residual would fall below that allocated cost basis. There are also, I think some of you have also raised concerns about recognition of day one profit, in particular if there are, say, significant service pieces. And you know, what if that allocation wasn't done properly, there could be some recognition of day one profit on services that have yet to be delivered. And I suppose there's two ways we think, or there's two reasons why that concern could be addressed. I think one is that the board's, in terms of how a lessor does an allocation of payments between lease components and non-lease components, we've said the lessor should look to the revenue recognition model, so it's basically the same as a seller would do its allocation in a revenue contract. I think the other reason is, even if we do still think there's uncertainty about that allocation, we are already proposing that we would include guidance in the standard that would say, look, if you have any uncertainty around the profit figure, you know, don't recognise it at lease commencement. And we could certainly make that words, you know, wide enough to apply to a situation of allocating between lease and service components. Now, clearly, despite what I've said in paragraph 33, and some of you has already been mentioned, might may still be uncomfortable about recognising, you know, any manufacturer profit when less than substantially all the risks and rewards have been transferred. So another way, of course, as has been mentioned, to deal with this is that we could, to Tom's point, draw a different line in terms of when profit, you know, is recognised at lease commencement and when it's not. And that line could be drawn at a substantially all the risks and rewards line. So with that, we can talk about lessor accounting. We're going to get to portions next, so we'll try and keep off portions, but otherwise thinking about a manufacturer lessor when it's a whole underlying asset.
Can I just get a very simple example, Katrina, just so we're absolutely certain we know what we're talking about. Let's say we've got an asset carrying value 100, fair value 120. We're going to lease it for two-thirds of its life, mm-hmm. and the residual, the receivable is going to be 80. Mm-hmm. So that means then that the residual value is going to be 40. If you talk about fair value terms, that's what is in approach one, is that right? So you would show 80 of a residual, 80 of a receivable, 40 of a residual, and you would strike profit of 20. Is that right? Because the carrying value is 100.
That's approach two.
Well, I thought two was the other one, where you're actually based on a cost value.
No, sorry, approach one is the cost.
Oh, beg your pardon, I've got them mixed up, have I?
But that's right, so the 80 and the 40 measurement of the residual would be approach two.
Okay, and I take, under that method, if we were to accept it, we get a profit up front of 20.
20, yes.
Which I don't like.
Yeah.
And the second one, then, I would take as a residual, I still have the receivable of 80, mm-hmm. but I would have then, in fact, I still had a third of the value. I would have that third of the value at cost, which is 33. Mm-hmm. So I'd still have a profit up front, but a lower one.
Yes. It would be 13 then of profit, yep. I think.
And why not no profit? So why not the modified approach that I don't take profit and I accrue to the residual?
And that's approach B in paragraph 37.
Yeah. And I suppose that the original thoughts from the staff on approach one around that case is that if we believe in the model, why would we prevent someone taking that portion of profit if we felt reasonably comfortable and certain about the measurement of the profit?
But usually for the finance leases, that's almost the whole life. It's the whole. No, I don't think I want to.
I think David was saying whether it's finance lease or not, why would you recognise profit in those circumstances? And I'm saying you already do under current practice for finance leases.
No, we're talking about if you have it for whatever we call it, substantially all or something like that, you've really given the guy the asset, take the profit, that's fine. But where it's, I've got a big chunk left, I'm very wary of taking a big chunk of profit up front. Based on the residual value.
To take the profit when, I mean, I think, Tom, you said when the rest and wars, and you could say you transfer control of the underlying, but I thought Petrina's getting to that because the paper has a cut to do with the uncertainty associated with the residual, which is what you're saying, Dave.
I'm harder than that. I just think that I'm always uncertain about the residual value. Frankly,
right. Okay. So, but are you at at Tom's suggestion, it's a significant risks and rewards transfer. And be happy then.
If it's insignificant risk and rewards, you still get some profit in period one. It's just you'd have it in period one, two, and three, and four, or whatever whatever that period is.
Is that what you're saying, or are you saying anything less than substantially all you defer and take out of the way?
I would defer it, and I would accrue up to the residual value that you estimated. So you'd get a gain each year, but over the time of the lease. So you'd end up with the residual value you estimated when you started.
But so basically, but Katrina said that it's a matter of where you draw the line, and I think the staff are saying, You've sussed out the feelings of the board. If you get any chance of having some sort of consensus view here, we've got to draw a line somewhere where if you're above the line, you recognise your day one gain. If you're below it, you don't, and you recognise it over time. And I think Tom's saying substantially all the risks and rewards transferred, recognise it. So are you, I think, below that line.
Should test Larry in this one. He was...
No, I agree. I can live with that as well.
As a performance approach in terms of profit recognition and a derecognition approach in terms of balance sheet.
That's right. I think it's a better model.
I have a question for you, David. My question, we're throwing around this term substantial risks and rewards. Are you saying that if you lease an asset for, let's say, only a third of its life or two-thirds of its life, that you are not able to transfer substantially most of the risks and rewards because you haven't transferred the use of that asset for substantially all of its life? Are you using time relative to economic life as the basis for determining whether you've transferred substantially all the risks and rewards? Because I could make the case, I have an asset, an airplane, has an economic life of 30 years, and I transfer it to John for 10 of those years, I could make the case that he has substantially all the risks and rewards for the 10 of the 30-year period. And my understanding also, the way approach two works, is that you're accreting the residual value just for that 10 of the 30 years, not the whole of the economic life. Okay? So the concern about upfront profit recognition, I think, has a couple of governors around it. One, you're only talking about the residual, the economic period, or excuse me, the lease period over which you're leasing the asset, not the entire economic life of the lease. And the second one is this criteria that we're throwing around, substantial risks and rewards, which I don't think necessarily needs to be tied to the time period that you're actually leasing the asset.
I presume the proposal from people is that it's the line that we discussed before. It's the IS 17, substantially all the risks and rewards line, which isn't necessarily solely about time. It takes into account the four indicators that.
So to their point, you could still get a gain day one if I'm only leasing it for one third of its economic life.
If it's most of its value.
Yeah, or there's a residual value guarantee in there, for example.
Yeah, but you're only recognize the gain that you're recognizing is only that portion over which you're leasing the asset, not the entire economic life of the asset.
That's correct.
That's right. So, I guess I'm less concerned about what people are saying here. You know that we're potentially upfronting profit, as long as we're meeting the criteria that we've laid out in the revenue recognition project.
Okay, there's a few people trying to come in here. Can we just work my way around here, PK?
Just to ask a question on the residual. First of all, I think we should congratulate David for his promotion into partnership. So, David, you and I spent time on the Excel sheet to work on the residual asset. Question for the staff. If I know the value of the residual asset, does approach one people still believe you need to impute the residual value asset, value of the residual? If I know I'm in the equipment leasing business, I know exactly what my residual is.
Yes.
But would I still have to impute the residual? Why would I need to impute residual value? Because residual value is dependent on many factors. Mm-hmm. By imputation, right? Because it is dependent primarily on the receivable. Mm-hmm. lease receivable, the way we have defined, does not include contingent rents and lease options. Many factors will go into the picture, which for accounting purposes we don't take into consideration. Mm-hmm. But a true lease economics will decide what is the economics of that transaction are, and what are the economics of the transaction are, and they value the residual asset differently. So for me, imputing a residual value has a lot of problems. And John stole my thunder by saying that for the balance sheet, we are doing derecognition. For income statement, we are doing performance. If that is a theory behind it, I would suggest to keep the residual value at its true value. What is the true residual value that people can estimate it? We need to accrete to that number rather than an imputed number, which can have any number of issues. I can spend 15 minutes talking about the mistakes that can happen because of imputation. It's the same thing. Any profit deferrals. We need to think about it. That doesn't stop us from recognizing the true residual value.
Your approach too.
Yeah. So you take profit up front.
That's a different issue. First of all, we got to understand what is the residual value. Then we can think about what should we do with the profit recognition separately.
I'm not sure it is, because you can always get a residual value, and then you've got to decide what you do with it. And that's the issue you've got, because the receivable's fixed. So you've either got, if you don't want a profit, you've got to adjust the residual. Pat? Oh, sorry, where are you going?
First, I think we should first forget about the credit loss first.
Don't get loss. Don't get into that.
Yes, and continue rental, forget. Okay? And then we are talking about, you know, whether we should have one or two model again. And then we have, in my mind, there are two different kind of version of two model. One two model is, you know, on the one side, the derecognition model, partial derecognition, or on the other side, operating lease model. And another variance of two model is, you know, use derecognition at all, but defer part of the profit.
Some of the time.
Okay. Then the question is, no, let's assume the second variance, not the first variance. Derecognize first, then only the part of the profit, whether should recognize immediately or not. Am I right?
Yeah.
If that is the case, I don't agree to draw a line based on risk rewards notion. You know, if you look at the current standards, risk rewards means you rewards by using the asset or appreciation or risk is a possible, you know, ups, leases, and others. I would think, you know, as a lessor, you will still have the risk rewards only related to the part related to the residues. And the other side have a similar risk rewards, but on the other part, they got. So I think we have different version of interpretation of risk rewards. Traditional interpretation give people impression the risk rewards of the whole asset. But based on the contract, the lessor will pay you, we are discussing about non-cancelable contract. Lessor will pay you based on the contract. And we will not discuss about credit risk. And so I would think the lessee take the risk rewards of that part, and the lessor will hold risk rewards of the other part. So I don't think it is necessary, you know, to draw a line between them. And for the lessee side, got that part, I would agree to recognize that. Now, if there is no problem of the continued rental credit loss, and the lessor, of course, can recognize revenue and recognize profit. Why not? I would agree. For the remaining part, the lessor should not recognize profit. And that is the model one, or the approach one. I fully agree with.
So you would take profit on the residual up front, would you?
No.
It's approach one.
Yeah, approach one. Yeah, the idea, I think the idea from the staff very good. You know, only recognize profit of the portions you transfer out. The other portion you will not recognize the profit.
Okay.
But end of the period, what is the residual number?
There's several people signaling. Down.
I'm probably going to say something very similar to what Weigo said. To my mind, we very clearly identified that a right of use asset is a real asset. We've very clearly identified as part of this whole process that that asset, that right of use asset, is transferred from one person, the lessor, to the lessee, and that in the hands of the lessee it will be used up so that there's nothing that's transferred back. And we've clearly said there's something that stays behind, which we're calling the residual. To revalue the residual doesn't make any sense to me because it stayed behind. It hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't moved. It should stay at the valuation. But I can't see any argument for saying that if I have transferred a clearly identifiable asset to somebody else for consideration, that consideration exceeds the value of that asset in my books, that I haven't made a profit. And the only reason I would argue that you can't recognize a profit in that circumstance is if you say the profit is so uncertain you don't know what it is. But that's the second test. The first test is to recognize the profit because that has happened. The second test is to test whether or not there's enough certainty about the recognition.
Okay. Steve?
I agree with what Darrell just said until right at the end when he said, if profit is so uncertain, then don't recognize it. So to me, that's not a high enough hurdle. I wouldn't do risks and rewards. I think others have said this. I mean, in revenue recognition, we're not going down that path. So we're looking at control and then reliability. And I would do the same thing here and build on reliability. What the staff have, and I'm looking at paragraph 33, top of page 16, what the path staff have there is sort of consistent with what Darrell was just saying, that if the residual value at the end of the lease term was highly uncertain, such that the residual value could fall below the amount allocated, that sort of highly uncertain seems to me that it's very rarely going to be tripped, and you would very rarely not recognize a profit. It's sort of consistent with the recognized profit unless it's unreliable type notion. Now, I'd turn it the other way around, and I would say only recognize a profit if it's reasonably certain. And I would say you should only recognize profit if it's reasonably certain that the residual, that the value of the asset at the end of the lease is going to be greater than the accreted residual value. So you're accreting the residual. You get to a certain value. If it's reasonably certain that the value of the asset at that point is going to be greater than that, then fine, I'd recognize a profit. Or whatever level of probability you desire. If reasonably certain is too much, then select the appropriate level. But I'd do it on a reliability basis, not a risks and rewards basis.
And on that basis, would you take any upfront?
Yeah, so if you can be reasonably certain that you've got a profit, then I take the profit. If there was uncertainty about that profit, then I wouldn't take it. And I would include both the uncertainty about what the residual value of the asset is at the end of the lease and the uncertainty about the amount of the services that's inherent. So I think there's uncertainty in two respects in respect to the lease. And going the risk and rewards approach, or going the sort of the operating lease approach, that the problem with that is that you estimate the residual value and then you depreciate the asset to that residual value. That's not very, can be a bit reckless as well. If there's uncertainty about that residual value, you do end up recognizing the full profit over the lease term. But what I'm suggesting is that you go approach one, which sort of limits it anyway, and then have a reasonable certainty test about getting that profit before you would then recognize the gain. Otherwise, you'd defer it.
Can I ask you a question?
Maybe it's something. If I'm correct, if I hear you correctly, you're actually suggesting that we apply similar criteria to what we have in the revenue recognition model for constraining revenue.
Yeah, it has to be modified, obviously, because it's slightly different.
But a similar notion. So you've said control's passed.
Yeah.
Now we look separately at whether we should recognise all of that revenue or gain on day one, or whether it should be constrained because of uncertainty around the measurement.
Yeah, and then we can decide what the level of comfort we want in terms of recognising that profit.
Okay. John?
Well, I agree very much with what Vago, Daryl, and Steve have said. I think we should, first of all, try to get one model. I think it's very awkward not to have one model. I think to go on risk and rewards in the case you gave, David, I think is very awkward for me at least. Two-thirds of the product has been sold. Volkswagen has produced and delivered 1.5 million cars. They have no revenue, they have no profit. I think that is not a good way of describing what they have done. They have transferred value to someone who's in total control over a period. I don't think, so I'm very much in line with this approach one. I think we have a good solution there. I don't think we should be a little bit careful on how we establish the residual value, which is perhaps a technicality, because the curves of how the value is developing is not just a straight line. And of course, that should be somehow be taken into consideration. So I think we should really take approach one.
Okay, I've got PK and then,
Approach one, the staff themselves admit that it is not economics of the transaction, of the pricing. The staff themselves agree in the thing.
No, I'm just saying that approach one, the staff themselves acknowledge that it is not reflective of the economics of the transaction.
It doesn't strictly reflect the pricing. It still gets you, in terms of the interest income that's recognized, it still gets you a more sort of consistent rate of return in a sense.
And if I know the residual value, why would I accrete it to a lower number? And I just don't get it.
The accrete of interest is next step. We should not confuse, We are now talking about, first we'll model, then whether or which part of the profit we should reckon on, should be allowed to reckon on day one. As to how to accrete or whether we should revalue that residual is another issue.
No, let's not get there just yet. Because,
yes.
Sorry.
The only one maybe.
Any more? No. Is it John or Darrell?
John. I kind of liked the substantially all, but I thought of it the way Stephen described it. I thought if it was substantially all, there was very little uncertainty about the residual, and therefore taking the profit made sense.
Yep.
To me, the more uncertainty about the residual, the more I'm uncertain whether I really got the profit or not. So Stephen used words of reliability, uncertainty, reasonable certainty. Maybe we need to tease that out and understand what we're trying to get to as a cutoff. But my notion, and it wasn't so much I'm looking at risks and rewards as the key, I was looking at if I transferred substantially all, I know I've got that gain. And so that's the certainty, if you will, that I thought made the difference. I also like this notion of a derecognition model. In some cases, you're going to recognize a portion of what you've sold and take a gain. In some cases, you don't. And it would be based on some uncertainty notion.
Okay, Darrell and then Tom.
Maybe two points. I think to answer PK first, I think the fact that you haven't transferred the residual to somebody makes it very tough for me to see how you can take a profit on that. Because in essence, what you're doing is you're picking an asset on your balance sheet that has historically been carried at cost, and you're suddenly deciding to fair value that, because it's gone nowhere and it's done nothing. To pick up on John's point, I think you may very well get to the same point a lot of the time. But there are going to be circumstances where you are more certain about your residual, even if you're only giving it, leasing the asset out for a third or for a quarter of its life. And to my mind, I think it's that certainty. I don't see why the test here of certainty should be any different to the revenue test of certainty. And as long as you've got the consistency of those two, you may well get the answer you're looking for most of the time anyway.
Tom?
I was like John. I thought I heard the model that we've been talking about relative to what Steve has been saying. I thought the same way, that if I transfer virtually all the risk and rewards, that's like revenue recognition, because to be able to transfer the asset to someone else, you have to transfer almost all the risk and rewards and have power over it to recognize revenue. If what you do is you don't transfer all the risk and rewards, that means you've got a lot of uncertainty in the residual. That did, we sort of are having a conversation as if you recognize all the revenue what you transferred or none. That's not the case. The case is either you transfer all of it and you get the revenue up front for what you transferred, or you say there's enough uncertainty that you recognize revenue through time, which I think is very consistent to the revenue recognition issue, is if you have continual transfer, you recognize revenue continuously over time. And I would deal with the circumstance about uncertainty of the residual over time with an impairment test on the residual. So that's how I would deal with the other issue you raised. So I think there's two different approaches to deal with this. I think the biggest difference we're having about this is I don't trust people's ability to do residuals well. And even if they could, we're not going to put enough governors in this model to force them to do it well so that they will be able to say they measure it well and they get it all up front. And that's part of the problem I'm having here, but I also think there's a revenue recognition consistency too.
Tom, what about a situation where there wasn't a great deal of risk in the residual, that there's a market out there and it's been stable? You might end up not transferring substantially all of the risks and rewards, but because the risks and rewards are low, the risk that you do retain itself is quite low. So why is...
Wouldn't that be in a risk and rewards model, therefore full revenue up front for the portion transfer?
You might transfer 50% of the risks, but because the risks are very low, the risk that you retain may not be significant in terms of constraining the recognition of profit. That's what the equipment leasing people are telling us. We have a lot of experience in a particular area, the assets that Jan was referring to. We think we can measure the profit reliably, even though we don't trip the 90% test.
I think in your example, Steve, you've transferred 50% of the rewards, but in fact you have retained very little risk in what's left. And why wouldn't you?
I think it should be an absolute measure of risk uncertainty rather than a relative. So transfer substantially all conjures up a 90% or whatever, 75 or whatever it is. I think it should be an absolute test of the risk uncertainty that you retain.
But once you do that, why would you...
Hang on.
No, once you do that, I agree with you. I have not been arguing with the aspect about at what point in time you should recognize profit. But once you know that, and to the joint's point, which I've been harping, if you know very well you're going to transfer substantially all the thing, why would you still impute residual value when you know it? Why would you impute? I just don't get it.
I mean, clearly there's a massive overlap between what I'm saying and what Tom's saying. I mean, the vast majority of situations are going to give the same answer. It's just the way we choose to articulate it, I guess.
Yeah, my reaction would be, if we're really worried about that, we ought to look at the criteria that we've developed for risk and rewards to make sure we're comfortable.
But I think I hear Steve coming at it differently. Are you saying, for example, if in the used car market, you know that coming off of a 3-year lease, the value of the car is going to be very close to X. In that case, you describe this model by saying we're going to put the residual on at X and take the gain.
No.
The difference between the receivable and X is your gain.
I would still do method one.
Okay, then I'm not
still
understanding.
Still, it costs. It's a matter of whether you recognize the gain.
But there would be a gain.
Transfer.
There would be a gain.
On what was transferred. You'd have a gain on the transfer of the cars for however many years.
Portion transfer.
His focus wants to be with what you retain and its relative value rather than how much what you gave up.
Okay, that's what I said.
Sorry for getting excited. Is everybody thinking the residual asset that you are going to get by this imputation is equal to the cost of that residual value, that portion of the cost of that residual value? Is that what you're saying, that by imputing this residual value, are you saying that if there's a 50% transfer life of the, if you have a 10-year car and you transfer 5 years of car, the remaining 5 years residual that you're calculating by this methodology, is it equal to 50% of the book value? I hope.
Undiluted.
Yes.
No, I don't think it will be. It will be 50% of the book value of the asset.
That was my point when I said you have to be.
I think Leslie was thinking it is.
You have to apply the curve, the realistic curve of the market value, which is not sort of a straight line. You have to apply that somehow when you make this estimate, and then you allocate how much you have sort of handed over of the value of the equipment and how much you have to come back.
Yeah, but that's a technicality.
It doesn't change really the conclusion. And in your case, David, for example, you had a 20% producer's margin. So you can say that on top of your residual value, you had the producer's margin as a cushion. So you could take a 20% hit on the value of the residual value without taking a loss. So I think that would work very well.
But the point I'm trying to make is that that number is not cost, nor it is fair value. It is an imputed number. It's an allocated number, and that allocation is dependent on the lease receivable, and that lease receivable is dependent on the then market movements, and that number has no meaning. That's all I'm trying to argue. That's where I've been saying from the beginning.
Everybody's talking at once.
The cost. There's two issues.
One
is whether or not you recognize a gain or not. Okay, we have criteria. I think most of us are in agreement that we're going to use the RevRec criteria, control, transfer. That's not necessarily, I think, that controversial. The other issue, though, is measurement. And as he said, this formula in paragraph 20A is a calculation. Okay, and some people would prefer that because they are less confident about people's ability to estimate residuals, and other people would say use fair value. So I think you have to distinguish, you know, where the uncertainty, quote, lies. Is it in the whether you should recognize the gain or whether or not it's the way you're measuring the gain?
So could I just check with you on that basis, if you had the thing at 100, as we mentioned, the fair value of the receivable is 80. The fair value of the estimated fair value of the residual is 40. So the total fair value is 120. On approach one, you would just take one third, because the residual is one third of the value of that cost of 100, you'd have 33.
Yes.
Okay. So in total now, you're swapping an asset of 100 for an asset of 113, because that's the 80 plus the 33, and you would instinctively then take 13 up front. That's what you're saying, yeah?
Right, and that would leave the 33 frozen.
Yes. Okay, you wouldn't accrue up to 40 or anything like that.
No. Frozen for the whatever, and the asset.
Well, you could have another lease, of course. You could have another lease. Okay.
That's not what we recommend.
No, it wasn't what I
No, we would. I mean, we'd agree with the 13, but then we'd accrete the residual using the region contract.
Okay.
Yeah, not to 40. No, not to 40.
33.
Why not over the time?
30, it would be somewhere like 36. It would be using the rate in the contract, so it would be accreted up somewhere 36, 37.
Mechanically, you're going to use the investment number, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Rather up to fair value. Yes, that's very good.
It sounds like a twist on it, David.
You
have to
try. Try another one. You don't lease it from me. You buy it. But I give you a trade-in guarantee. So you can trade it in for 33. I take the full profit up front, right? Revenue? Yes, I mean, it's very, 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 very similar.
Okay, can we just, if we take this in part, is there general agreement that you'd be You could accept the asset on the balance sheet as a receivable and a residual? The question is, how do we value this residual? I mean, that's where we are. Does anyone really object to that sort of idea, if we can fix how we take profit? I mean, is that the issue we're talking about?
Except portions, though.
And we haven't come to portions yet. That's right.
Are we assuming some level of reliability?
We're still to come to that, Leslie. It's just thinking, how do we take the profit if we do? Some of us don't want to take any, but the...
So you do in some cases.
Only if you got rid of most of it.
That's current. That's current gap, though. I mean, we do that today. So I mean,
of course, yeah.
Why would we want to get so fatuzzed about that?
Yeah. What's that word?
Are you walking it down the elaborate path?
No.
You're talking balance sheet. Just balance sheet.
Just balance sheet. Just balance sheet.
At the moment.
Just balance sheet.
Yeah, just balance sheet.
Okay. Can we move on to the income statement now? We've got two approaches here. And if we could just use that number that I mentioned, the 80 and 33 under method 1, 80 and 40 under method 2, 80 and 20 under the modified approach. That when you're uncertain, you don't take any gain whatsoever. Okay?
I don't think you can ask the question about the uncertainty until we decide what the there's question, there's the line. The first question on whether it's the 80 and 40 or 80 and 33 is a valid question.
Yeah. Is what?
That's a valid question.
Okay. All right, we'll leave the uncertainty aside. Can we just get an idea roughly where people stand? Should we not vote in boards? Should we just sort of vote and then we can, because there's still plenty to do in this. Approach one versus two, okay. So approach one is the 33, approach two is the 40. Okay?
Allocation versus fair value.
Yeah, allocation. Okay. I got it wrong the first time.
Present value residual would be correct. Yeah, voted present value residual.
Okay.
So, David, the key is approach two will recognize all profit at front.
No, not necessarily.
We're not talking about the income statement.
We'll come on how what certainty before you can get it in a minute. Okay, who would prefer approach, if you're going to have one of these two, who would prefer approach one? Oh, well, it's well done.
I just don't believe it.
Okay, we're on approach one.
Okay.
We've 17 minutes to try and fix this accounting forever.
I'll do you on exchange.
The next question is the certainty issue. You know, at the moment you'll be taking 13 profit up front. Now, what's the constraints that we should put in there just to make sure this isn't numbers that have come out of nowhere?
Something that's modified from revenue.
Sorry, Warren.
Well, it's revenue recognition, as Larry said. You've got control, plus we just work on what's in the revenue recognition model to make it applicable in this context.
Can we?
Yeah, so you got any suggestions?
I just heard there's two different views on this. One is that the hurdle is you have to have transferred substantially all of the risk towards the underlying asset. And the other is that it's a certainty about the residual and therefore the profit calculation, which I think is more like Steve's line of thinking. And so you could certainly build the revenue reliability of, you know, before you can recognise the revenue and use that to sort of specify the residual. And that would mean that, you know, you've got good experience with those residuals and you've got that confidence in effectively that the residual will turn out to be what you've priced it to be.
So it's not a one-off thing.
Yeah, so
how do you prove that?
Same way you do in revenue.
Well, you know, I think you just have to have the access to the evidence to be comfortable about those residual. I mean, remember, people, the residual that we're talking about here, people have used that to price the contract. Yeah, I mean, this isn't a number they make up. This is a
whole business.
You know, this is a number that's, and you are going to subject to an impairment test from day two. That's right.
It is the essence of how, I mean, that managing the residual and estimating the residual is a way, sort of, you know, the leased car and equipment leasing business works. That is their business. It's, in fact, making estimations.
Are we going to get a paper on this guy?
On what? How we would word...
How we make the cut.
How we word the reasonably assured certainty.
Yeah. Can we just test how people feel? We haven't got the words. but if we use the... control and whatever reliability words that we come up with, would you be happy with taking that upfront profit? Who would not be happy of taking upfront profit?
I'd be concerned until I see the word.
John Smith again proves himself.
Oh, well, Smith, you just said okay. You go with it.
Well, it's just to give the staff a steer which way we go.
If they could hedge that remember.
Excuse me, David, can I object to what John's just done?
What did he say?
No, you said before you'd go with this, and then you say, oh, I've got to see the words. Now, you've got to at least give the staff an opportunity to come up with some words that are robust enough.
I objected on the basis I haven't seen the words. I'm willing to see what the words are and reconsider.
Put your hand down. There's no problem.
Pardon me?
Keep your hand down then.
No, I'll put my hand up.
No faith in the staff.
Listen to you. You think you're Leisenry?
Ring your bell, David.
Well, I voted again. I voted to defer the profit. I'll just explain why. Maybe it'll help you. Number one is I don't think an unreliability threshold is going to help. I think they price it. I think we're talking about major equipment, lessors. I think they know within a fairly close range what the residual is. So I don't think that's going to help at all. I don't know how to apply revenue recognition control to this. There's been no legal transfer of title. And if you take it one place, any lease, there's transfer of control. But yet there's massive amounts of continuing involvement by the lessor. So I would kind of need an analysis as to when does an equipment lessor actually transfer control. I've always thought of a leasing activity as, in essence, a performance obligation. Unless you've transferred substantially all, then you've sold it. That's where I would put the cut, which is similar to IAS 17. What's that?
You drive a Lexus.
I drive a Lexus, yeah. do I have control of it? They pay the... Well, it depends on what your definition of control is. I can take it wherever I want, but there are certain things I can and can't do. I can't take it out of the country.
I'm not sure.
I can't sell it. I have to pay them back for the taxes they paid.
I mean, just to come back on this, I think that talking about control here, maybe it's not relevant. We've already talked about control in the context of what is a lease, you know, and it only is a lease if the lessee has obtained control of the use of the underlying. If it was about controlling the underlying, then you're into revenue and it's not.
That's right. I wasn't sure that control was going to be that much of a filter on this issue, unless you're trying to set the hurdle. You have to transfer control of the whole of the underlying for the whole of its life.
I wasn't either, but everyone kept saying we should base it on revenue. I don't understand how control works here.
I didn't see that as being the particular issue. I thought it was more the reliability.
It's more the wording of reasonably assured, and you're pretty certain you're going to get this with an impairment test to make sure you can't.
That's right.
Yeah. That's what the is that broadly what people went for?
Yep.
So we've got to get the words.
Wait, but I think what I hear people saying is you're going to meet that all the time.
If it's a reliability threshold, I would like to test this, but I think equipment will almost always meet it, and real estate is where the issue is.
And you don't agree with that for all equipment leases, is what you're saying?
No, I don't think all equipment leases are the same. I don't think they should all get day one gain, but that's okay.
Can we just get a view of the boards, just in case, you know, one board's in one direction, one's in the other? Who would be happy to explore that? Could we do ISB? Who would be happy to explore this idea of take the profit up front and some reasonable assurance or something like that, whatever words we come up with? 5, 6, 7, 8, 12. Okay.
12.
Okay. Could we try FASB?
Excuse me. Was that 14? Was it? And FASB? Who voted against it?
Me.
We're looking for direction.
Could we just see who would be happy with the reasonably assured on the FASB side, or words, you know, whatever that is? Who would be happy with that?
That's not what you asked.
Sorry, well, whatever the question was. To explore, to move forward, to explore. You're absolutely right. Who would be happy in the FASB side to go and explore that sort of approach?
Come back with John's words.
Come back with the words.
Two.
Two. Two. Two.
And I wouldn't object to exploring it. I mean, it's not boxed in, right?
Me neither.
Okay, well, it's
my hurdle's higher than you.
Can I clarify just the exploring? Would the exploring being exploring as in bringing you back a board paper, or would exploring being showing you drafting? And
can I make a suggestion? Just building on what Tom said, I think maybe the point of difference here is the threshold.
Yeah.
People like Tom would say, reliably measurable is just not high enough, and you'd go to risks and rewards, substantially, or risks and rewards transferred. Maybe if the staff was just to compare and contrast those two.
Okay, should we do that?
Yeah. And that's the difference I hear.
Is that okay? And using approach one.
Yeah. We just discussed the initial measurement, I think. So subsequent measurement of the residual asset, what it will be?
That's a fair point to make, because we doing the question, is it frozen or does it accrete to something?
Yeah.
It's a pro-rec.
Our recommendation was obviously to accrete that over the term. What was included in the exposure draft around the derecognition approach was an allocated cost basis with no accretion. And we certainly heard a lot of feedback back that with no accretion of that number, it really doesn't reflect what's happening in the lease contract.
That was Warren's idea at that time.
Thank you.
In terms of how it was priced, so we have a couple of paragraphs in the paper that tries to set out why we recommend accreting the residual. It doesn't get accreted right up to, in David's example, the 33 would not be getting accreted right up to the 40. It would be accreted up to some number in between because you'd use the rate in the contract. So we'd get accreted to 36, 37, whatever. But we do recommend accretion simply because it better reflects how the lease contract would be priced, and it would give more sort of a constant rate of return.
Why do you use the rate of return in the lease and not 40?
I suppose it's back to if we accrete it up to 40, we'd end up then taking all of the manufacturing profit over the lease term. And I suppose the basis we felt around the approach one was what you're saying is I'm recognising profit on what I've transferred to the lessee. Because I've retained the residual, I'm not going to recognise any profit on that residual until the end of the lease term, which is why we do say, in fact, in many cases, approach one could be considered to be more prudent or at least slower in terms of profit recognition than even current operating lease accounting.
Yeah, but you get lumpiness at the end, though.
Exactly. In your method of approach one, if you accrete it only to 33, when you re-release it, you'll have a bigger profit.
Absolutely.
So you're not trying to hide the profit. It's only lumpiness you're creating artificially.
Well, I think it depends on what you think is happening, because I think that under the approach one, it would say that you've entered into a transaction at the start of the initial lease term, which means you can recognise profit and that, assuming it's reasonably certain. And then there's a separate transaction that would happen if you release it or sell it at the end of the lease term, and at that time, it's appropriate to recognise profit on that cost.
Katrina, when you bring that back, I don't think there's a problem with the bank that's leasing a brand new piece of equipment. Okay, that's not a problem. You need to think about releasing a property. So if you got a piece of equipment with a 20-year life and you're 7 years into it, and then they're taking it, the formula you use needs a fair value of that piece of equipment. So we got to think about the degree to which you can get a reliably measurable fair value, because that's the crux of what the profit's going to be. So you need to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, just if it helps at all in terms of, the lumpiness to concern at PK, we have worked through an example, but we didn't want to give you any more numbers and appendices. But what in fact the approach one would mean is that assuming, as we say, and we could use the numbers in approach one, that what there is that, there's the full manufacturing profit in that example of 1250, which is 12.5%. What the approach one actually means is the profit that you take, the 1017 profit that you're taking on day one of the initial lease, means a 12.5% return on your original asset. And if you accrete that up to what we're proposing, which is a lower number than its estimated residual, when you would release that again, you would again recognise a profit of 12.5% when you release it. So I know that in between PK, the residual number may not represent much in particular, but it does mean that you are recognising a return initially on that transaction, which is transferring the right of use, and then you again recognize a profit when you release or sell it on a piece of the asset at that time, which would be an equivalent 12.5%.
Okay, is that worth going forward on that basis for the team? Bring that back? Okay.
We done?
Yeah, well, I was just going to, we can't get on to portions tonight, but we will do that tomorrow.
Can a couple of people take Russ out for dinner tomorrow? Give him a few limoncellos. Larry, could you organise
that? So we'll start again at, I don't know what time it is now, there's a meeting at 10:45. Okay. Sign up for refresh.